Hello and welcome. I'm Ben Schultz.
I'm Nora Schultz.
And you're listening to Trying to Adapt, and today we're trying to adapt to Esmeralda or The Sensation Goat, an 1862 comic play by Henry James Byron.
It is everything that you are imagining from the title. So just to recap, in case anybody was wondering, like, wait a second, were there no hunchback adaptations between the 1830s and the 1860s? There were. There was an Italian opera written in 1838 that we didn't cover because there's not really that much info online about it. That was just called Esmeralda. There was a ballet called La Esmeralda from 1844. This one is pretty much identical to Hugo's opera, except there are no words, and Phoebus lives, and Quasimodo stabs Frollo to death. So after this ballet La Esmeralda in 1844, there was a Russian opera in 1847, again called Esmeralda, and again, there's not that much info about it. And then we have another opera named Esmeralda, also from 1847, also in Italian, and once again, there's not that much information about it, so I'm going to assume that it either wasn't very successful, wasn't very influential, or mostly followed the plot of Hugo's or Bertin's opera.
As comprehensive as we're trying to be on this podcast with, like, trying to get a hold of every adaptation and looking at every adaptation, some of them are going to be really similar to others. Combine that with the fact that some of them are just really difficult to get a hold of, and we are going to skip over a lot of things.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to do the best that we can.
That's just for all the real hunchback obsessives out there who are going to totally pounce on us.
Oh, I mean, if somebody is a big ballet fan out there, I would love to see their, like, very long assessment on this ballet. It's also in part that, like, we're not opera experts, we're not ballet experts, so there isn't much that we would be able to say about, like, the artistic qualities of these, even if we could find an easy way to track them down. So that is why we are skipping to The Sensation Goat, because it is short, it is a play, it is written in English, it was written in the UK. It is, I think I can easily say that this is the first humorous adaptation.
I mean, I don't think that ballets are usually a very funny medium.
Same with opera. This is really, like, this is like a vaudeville bit, basically.
So the whole thing is written in rhyme. There's a lot of wordplay. A lot of wordplay which doesn't make sense in the context of it taking place in the 1400s, and we'll get to that.
Interesting move. One of the first notes that I took was just Hamilton who, just because there are some rhymes that, like, you really have to kind of, like, read to yourself to get. Some of them are kind of stretching, but there are a few that, like, feel really solid.
There are a lot of rhymes that do not work if you're a 21st century American rather than a 19th century British person.
But it's the thought that counts.
I guess we can just get into it. We are introduced to our characters. Here we get kind of the first joke of the whole thing, because it says Quasimodo, deeply in love with Esmeralda. Claude Frollo is deeply in love with Esmeralda. Phoebus is deeply in love with Esmeralda. Like, this is how every character gets introduced. And then we get Ernest, not in the book.
Ernest is an OC. Do not steal.
We're told that he's deeply in love with himself. And Clopin is simply deep in every way. And most importantly of all is the titular goat. I don't think there's a single other adaptation of The Hunchback of Notre Dame out there where the goat is in the title. And I can only assume that the reason they did this is because they actually managed to train a goat to do all the stuff that the trained goat does in the book, and they were so proud of that fact that it was, like, the selling point. It was the reason why you should go to see the play in the first place.
To be fair, though, The Sensation Goat does sound a lot more interesting than just Esmeralda. I mean, I'm sure that back in, like, you know, the 1800s, Esmeralda itself sounded super exotic, you know, like, ooh, brown people. The Sensation Goat, I have to say, is a more entertaining title.
Yes. In the original production of this play, the goat that played Jolly is named Master Calino.
That is extremely charming. I didn't even notice that. Now I'm sad that, like, because now I'm thinking about the fact that there was a real goat that did this and is now dead. So this adaptation, like the opera, begins with, like, the beggars just kind of hanging out.
Oh boy. So their opening number is a song called Happy Are We Beggars So Gay, which is directly taken from a common minstrel song. And let's just say that in the original minstrel song, the word is not beggars. It rhymes with beggars.
Kinda, if you say it weirdly. But the highlight of this scene is that here Clopin, like, is actually taking time out of his day to, like, personally assign the, like, swindles that each beggar is going to perform.
And then he has, like, this little moment where he goes, you know what? I know that this is a bad way to live, and I really should stop doing it, but I keep doing it because I just love the feeling of having power over people like this. Which is wild. We never get character development from the beggars.
Especially not my man Clopin. So I was happy to see that personally. So shortly after this, Clopin hears that there is a quote-unquote spy who is just Pierre hanging around because he's poor and dumb.
Good old Pierre Gringoire has been evicted from his apartment, and he has decided to come to the Court of Miracles because that's where all the poor people live. Here is one of the first moments where you start to realize, wait a minute, they never actually said that this takes place in 1482. He rattles off this whole list of all the people he owes money to, one of which is the gas meter, definitely not a thing in 1482. Also, the milkman, I'm pretty sure they didn't have that in 1482. I think that came after, like, it was safe to just drink milk.
Coming from Mr. History Major over here.
Yeah, I'm a history major, and I can tell you that milk was not good to drink until very recently in history. Also, this is just buck wild. When he gets caught by the beggars, they ask him to, like, turn out his pockets and give them everything that he's got on him. And so he hands out, like, copies of a pamphlet he made where he basically is discussing his conspiracy theory about who really wrote Shakespeare's plays. Shakespeare, obviously, would not be born for 100 years after the story is supposed to take place, but they never said it takes place in 1482 this time, so who knows?
I didn't even think about that. Thank you for catching that. I think now is as good a time as any to point out that some of the puns in this are such stretches that there's, like, an explanation of what it means in parentheses, which I think is usually, like, if you are writing something with puns and you have to, like, explain what the pun means, you probably should rewrite that one.
Oh, I had to look some of the references up. Some of them are just, like, incredibly obscure things only someone who was alive at the time that this was written would actually get. And this guy, this Henry James Byron, wrote, like, dozens of these. He was just churning them out.
To be fair, this is probably how people are going to analyze SNL sketches, like, 150 years from now. So, of course, there's the scene where Pierre, his life can only be saved if a Romani woman comes and marries him. He says that he's already wedded to the muses, which basically means he's gay.
We all know what that means, wedded to the muses.
Esmeralda is kind of an interesting character in this because normally, you know, she's just kind of this damsel in distress. But here, like, her first bit of dialogue with Pierre is basically her telling him, like, not to talk about how beautiful she is because she's heard it so many times. So even though this adaptation isn't meant to be serious, I genuinely like Esmeralda here. Like, she has a personality for once.
Yeah, and she sticks up for herself, even after, like, saving Pierre Gringoire's life here. She kind of, like, makes fun of him several times, and then he makes fun of her, and then I guess there's kind of this mutual understanding that they just both, like, are pretty witty, and then they dance.
Yeah, they're just, like, they're really good friends in this. I appreciate that. There are a lot of lines in this that I would really like to hear rapped. The one that really stuck out for me was, "My Christian name is Claude, my surname Frollo. My heart, though very full, is very hollow." Holo? Frollo?
Yeah, okay, so judging by the rhymes, some of the rhymes that are used in this play, I can only assume that the person playing Frollo was pronouncing his name Frollo the whole time.
Which I really hate.
Now, you might be wondering why we just brought up Claude Frollo. Well, that is because immediately after Pierre Gringoire and Esmeralda are done with their dance, the beggars all clear out, and then Frollo shows up. He shows up with Quasimodo, who is, number one, referred to as his slave. Number two, Frollo, like, calls him over by calling him ugly.
Again, it feel like that.
Number three, he refers to Quasimodo frequently throughout the play as simply Q, which I like.
I am a big fan of that. I actually started using that in my notes.
And also, I have to suggest, maybe Quasimodo was QAnon all along.
Also, when Quasimodo enters, it says that, quote, music of a goblin-esque nature plays, which I am dying to hear. My Spotify account needs to know this music.
Yeah, sadly, unlike last time, we could not hear the music, but the plus side of that is that we could actually tell what was going on most of the time.
Yeah, this was around the point in the play where I realized that, like, this probably would be genuinely fun to see performed, even if I don't understand, like, most of the references. I like the characterization in general in this one. I like that Quasimodo says things jestingly to Frollo, even though he is his slave, once again. He doesn't seem to have nearly the same level as, like, unhealthy worship for Frollo. He kind of likes to fuck with him.
The reason that Frollo and Quasimodo have showed up in the Court of Miracles is because specifically Frollo, is planning to kidnap Esmeralda and wants Quasimodo to help him. Frollo explains that the reason he wants to do this is, surprise, surprise, because he's in love with her. And Quasimodo is like, fuck, because he also loves Esmeralda. And so as soon as Frollo starts telling him his plan for how they should kidnap Esmeralda, Quasimodo immediately begins thinking of ways to sabotage it. There's a lot of asides in this play. Here's a very key example, is just Quasimodo is just constantly saying stuff that, like, Frollo can't hear. They end up singing a duet together, Frollo and Quasimodo, which is apparently to the tune of Humpty Dumpty, which I have to point out is not a song.
Apparently it was in the 1860s. So when Esmeralda does show up, Frollo confronts her, and they exchange some dialogue, which continues to be funny. Again, like, this is not like most adaptations. I kind of wish it was. I would like to see more Hunchback-themed comedies. I will say that the line from Esmeralda to Frollo, "You are always a-frolloing me about," is just as funny as it was in 1864.
It is very funny, and it is also an interesting plot detail. Because usually when Frollo kidnaps Esmeralda, she isn't aware of the fact that Frollo has been, like, following her around, or that he loves her. In this adaptation, like, she knows, and he's been, like, stalking her very conspicuously for a long time. And she says, "My hate for you each day gets stronger." And he still thinks he has a chance.
In this adaptation, like, there's not really much character development or narrative build-up. It definitely, like, is going off the assumption that you know the story already. And I thought about this a little bit. Yeah, it's like one of those Hamilton parodies that they always advertise in New York or whatever. It's one of those things.
So this is when Frollo decides to begin to put in motion the kidnapping plan. Esmeralda freaks out when she sees Quasimodo, and then passes out, and Quasimodo runs off with her, but he didn't grab the goat, and the goat chases Frollo off stage, and then that's when Phoebus shows up. Quasimodo nearly manages to convince Phoebus that this is his wife that he's carrying, and she just passed out for, like, some completely normal reason.
Yeah, you know, Quasimodo's like, "This is my wife."
And then she starts to wake up, and Phoebus recognizes that it's Esmeralda.
Again, it's not explained how they met or know each other.
And Phoebus is like, I know that she's not married to you because I have also been in love with her for months.
Yeah, again, like, there's no watering of the hunchback, there's no dramatic rescue scene. Like, Esmeralda, they all just know each other. Small world, I guess. So Esmeralda and Phoebus start, like, macking on each other pretty quickly. Esmeralda calls Phoebus Fee, spelled P-H, and then the O and the E together. Again, I think this might be another nickname that I have to put into my notes.
Fee. So this is where we meet Ernest, who is kind of like Phoebus's sidekick. He just wants to get the shift over with. He wants to go party. He thinks Phoebus probably wants to go party, but Phoebus is way more interested in Esmeralda. And so Phoebus is like, okay, so I'm gonna go deal with Esmeralda, and Ernest, you can deal with Quasimodo. And he's like, yeah, thanks.
Yeah, also I do want to point out that, like, even though this is a comedy, Phoebus and Esmeralda's romance is mostly played straight here. Like, they don't really play up, you know, like, Phoebus being disinterested or only caring about himself. Like, he is genuinely in love with Esmeralda once again. And once again, like, Esmeralda is, like, thinking about how, like, but I'm just a humble gypsy woman and you are a rich soldier man. And Phoebus, like, being all, like, romantically woke. Which made me consider, like, how much, like, Bertine's opera would have had an impact on this play. And I thought, well, probably not much because it wasn't successful even in Paris. But then I remembered that the ballet that was mostly based on Bertine's opera was performed in London. If I'm wrong on that, someone call me out. But I think I'm right.
So, I mean, one thing to remember is that, especially in the 1800s, there are probably a lot of adaptations that just have been lost to time, any record of them at all. Just the fact that this comic play, this parody, existed in the first place is kind of like evidence that people in London not only knew the story, but that it was, like, significantly more popular than what we can dig up.
Yeah, and also the, kind of the lack of relation that the Sensation Goat has to the book probably also represents that there were even more opera adaptations than we have recorded, and a lot of them probably followed the general pattern of Bertine's and Hugo's, because it kind of laid the framework of how to adapt this story for a viewing, paying audience.
No shade, but I would be legitimately surprised if Henry James Byron had actually read the book.
Oh, I mean, there's really no evidence of that, because honestly, if he had, then he missed a lot of great jokes. So I think this is largely based off of other adaptations, which is why we try to go through this chronologically as much as possible. Fleur-de-Lis is kind of an interesting character here. She exhibits a lot of traits that we don't see in any other adaptation that I know of thus far. She seems to have genuine concerns about how getting married will basically be the end of her life.
Her social life, specifically.
Usually it's Phoebus who is dreading getting married, but Fleur-de-Lis doesn't seem too happy about it either here.
Yeah, and it seems like she kind of already knows that he's cheating on her.
At the very least, she knows that he's kind of a fucking asshole, because there's like 12 lines or something where Phoebus talks in rhymes about how, like, women need to continue to be pretty even after they've gotten married, that they shouldn't, like, let themselves go. And Fleur even, like, calls him out for this. Like, even by 1860s standards, this is like, okay, Phoebus, you're laying on the misogyny a little thick, buddy.
So you might be wondering if Phoebus doesn't want to get married to Fleur-de-Lis, and Fleur doesn't want to get married to Phoebus, why is this even happening in the first place? It's Fleur's mom who wants this to happen. It's Madame du Gondelaurier.
Yeah, there is absolutely not even a hint of romance between the two of them here. However, another interesting aspect of Fleur's character is that she is friends with Frollo.
I don't know about friends. I think what happened is Frollo kind of wrote her a letter telling her that Phoebus was cheating on her with Esmeralda. She has this kind of dilemma where, like, she doesn't trust Phoebus, but she also doesn't trust this creepy old guy who's trying to get them to break up for seemingly no reason.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why anybody would ever trust Frollo.
For that matter, why does he want them to break up exactly? Does he just, like, want to cause mischief and trouble? Because, like, you would think that not only would it not, like, help Frollo get a hold of Esmeralda by breaking up the wedding between Phoebus and Fleur-de-Lis, it might actually hurt him, because if Phoebus is no longer together with Fleur-de-Lis, then he's going to be more open in just trying to compete for Esmeralda.
Well, I mean, if anything, you think he'd want them to get married as fast as possible so that Phoebus has little opportunity to just kind of, like, recklessly go about catching women in the streets.
Yeah, this is never explained.
Most things in this play are not explained.
It certainly doesn't turn out well for Frollo.
So once again, there's this party scene where Esmeralda comes in, and Phoebus pretends not to know her at first, but then of course he gets caught because the scarf thing comes back. That's why I am assuming that Bertin's opera had at least some, like, level of influence on that, because, like, the scarf thing is not in the book at all.
The reason that Fleur-de-Lis even notices that Esmeralda is wearing her scarf is because Frollo points it out to her.
Yeah, this is an interesting party in this version. Like, Pierre Gringoire is there, and as soon as he finds out that Phoebus and Esmeralda are a couple, basically he finds out that he got cucked. He's, like, really happy about it. He's super stoked for the new couple, and I appreciate that energy in him.
So Esmeralda is actually, like, hired to perform at this wedding party. This is not, like, in the book or in the opera where it just so happens that she's performing in the square and everybody at the party is watching her and they're like, oh, come up here. No, this is, like, a plan that was made in advance. And you would think that if Phoebus wanted to prevent an awkward situation from happening where his girlfriend meets his fiancé, he maybe should have stopped them from hiring her and her fellow gypsies for the party. But whatever.
There's a really weird scene in this one where, like, pretty much the entire main cast is just kind of hanging around Esmeralda's, like, apartment, waiting for her to, like, come home.
Oh, this is super fucking weird. So, first of all, Quasimodo just, like, walks into the apartment, and he says something about, like, oh, I dug a tunnel into her room, which...
Huh?
How? How what does that mean? Does she live underground?
Yeah, Esmeralda's a mole man.
Or mole woman. He announces that he's here to steal Esmeralda's pie, because he's really hungry, and it seems like this is a euphemism for him wanting to have sex with her because he's really horny, but no, it turns out that he just literally wanted to eat some pie.
So that's his motivation in this scene. Once again, we have Frollo making plans with Clopin, like, they're, like, in cahoots. Again, it seems like it's mostly just, like, Frollo is paying Clopin to do some dirty work. In this case, you know, like, kill Phoebus.
What I want to know is, why didn't Frollo have any awareness of Quasimodo's surroundings at this time? I mean, if he is indeed Frollo's slave, shouldn't he at the very least know where he is, even if Quasimodo's not helping him at this exact moment? And for that matter, why isn't Quasimodo helping Frollo here?
Yeah, Quasimodo, I guess, just happened to think of eating Esmeralda's pie at the exact same time that Frollo was planning to kill Phoebus. Also, Pierre Gringoire is there? And keep in mind that Clopin is there too.
Well, okay, Pierre Gringoire is technically married to Esmeralda, so he's there because her apartment is also his apartment.
That's true. Yeah, he kind of has this, like, man-to-man chat in the sense that he's just kind of like, so we're married, but now you're with Phoebus? And it seems like maybe for a second he's going to be pissed about this, but he's just kind of like, well, okay.
So in this scene, you have Quasimodo hiding under the table trying to steal food while Phoebus and Esmeralda are having a nice romantic dinner. And Frollo and Clopin hiding in a closet, I think, or like a wardrobe or something, waiting to stab Phoebus.
It's honestly a great scene.
And you have Phoebus and Esmeralda, and Pierre Gringoire is also there.
I wish this was in the book. Victor Hugo would never.
Now, as you can probably imagine, because this is a comedy, this is the perfect setup for some very wacky hijinks. And so here's what happens. Quasimodo is super hungry, so while Phoebus and Esmeralda are eating dinner, he's stealing the food off of their table, and both of them think that the other one is the one who's eating all the food. So Phoebus is like, wow, I didn't know Esmeralda had such a big appetite.
And vice versa.
Once Quasimodo is done eating, he realizes, wait a minute, here's my chance to fuck up Frollo's plan to kill Phoebus. And he whispers to Phoebus, hey, just get the fuck out of here right now. And he does, and then when Frollo jumps out to stab Phoebus, he accidentally stabs Clopin instead and then goes and throws him in the river. And then Frollo calls the police and he's like, oh my god, Esmeralda just threw Phoebus in the river, because he doesn't even know that he actually stabbed Clopin.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it was, like, dark or something, because Pierre Gringoire also, like, does not back up Esmeralda, even though he's still there. He just kind of shrugs and goes like, man, this is awkward, am I right?
So then in the next scene, Fleur-de-Lis is waiting for news from Phoebus because, like, well, everyone thinks that he's dead. I don't know what Phoebus is actually doing while this is going on, but everyone thinks Phoebus is dead, and Fleur-de-Lis hasn't heard the news yet. And Ernest, the other policeman, comes up to Fleur-de-Lis, and he apparently, like, has the hots for her. He thinks about, like, telling her that Phoebus is supposedly dead, but then he thinks to himself, no, if I tell her that, she'll be too busy mourning to have sex with me, which is fucking wild.
You know, typical problem.
Made weirder by the fact that Fleur-de-Lis didn't give a shit about Phoebus and probably, like, would have been happy to hear that he was dead.
Oh, yeah, and, like, she was flirting with Ernest earlier, so this is just kind of, like, a natural progression of their relationship. And honestly, I think Fleur-de-Lis should end up with people who aren't Phoebus more often. Because I think it's pretty much either, you know, Fleur-de-Lis marries Phoebus and everyone else is dead, or Phoebus and Esmeralda get together and we never hear about Fleur-de-Lis again. Fleur-de-Lis didn't really do anything wrong, and I think she deserves better in this story. So I am honestly happy that this OC exists pretty much just to be funny and marry Fleur-de-Lis. That is absolutely fine with me.
I got two reasons for being in this play. Making jokes and marrying Fleur-de-Lis.
And I'm all out of marrying Fleur-de-Lis. So, after this little interlude, once again, Quasimodo, I don't quite understand Quasimodo's desire for vengeance, because, like, he hasn't killed Esmeralda yet. Frollo seems like he's kind of preparing to, like, watch Esmeralda's execution, but, like, we don't hear anything about her being a prisoner, or, like, it's not entirely explained why Quasimodo is so pissed at Frollo here. I mean, he has the right—
Hold on, no, okay. The whole timeline relative to the book is completely screwed up here. There is no sanctuary. Quasimodo never tries to save Esmeralda from being executed. So when they're trying to execute her, that's it. That's the one time that they're trying to execute her. They're combining the time that she's about to get executed and Quasimodo saves her with the time that Esmeralda gets executed for real and Quasimodo kills Frollo while they're both watching from the balcony. So they're combining those two things, which is wild because, like, you definitely don't see it coming if you are mostly familiar with the book and Hugo's opera.
And I also feel like you wouldn't really see it coming if you didn't know the story well, because, like, it doesn't— we don't get, like, any scene of Esmeralda being a prisoner. Like, we know she's arrested, and then the next scene is, like, Frollo, like, well, time to watch Esmeralda get executed. And before it even happens, or even seems to be starting to happen, Quasimodo pushes Frollo out of the window. However, he doesn't die.
That's where things get even more wild. Frollo survives the fall from the balcony of, like, the top of the church. Or is it? I don't think Frollo is referred to as a priest whatsoever in this version.
Oh, yeah, and I don't think Quasimodo is ever referred to as the bell ringer.
Yeah, I don't think there's any indication of what these people actually do.
Just two wacky guys wandering around Paris.
Perfect road trip buddy comedy.
Which, by the way, I would still love to see, so if any, as always, if anyone looking to make a literary adaptation is listening to this podcast for resources, I would pay to see that.
It's not clear what Quasimodo is pushing Frollo off of, but the important thing is he does push him off of it, and Frollo does survive, although he's like...
he's fucked up. He got his shit fucked up.
And he's covered in, like, glass shards. He's probably gonna die pretty soon. He's just not dead yet. He staggers up to where they're holding the execution, I guess just to get a closer look, and that's when Phoebus shows up, who is totally alive and never even got stabbed in the first place.
I also want to point out that, like, it's never really explained why Frollo wants Esmeralda dead. We know that he's in love with her, and we know that he's, like, frustrated that he can't get her, but it never, like, rises to the level of, like, oh, I'm in agony about this, because it's a comedy, you know? So he's just goes from, like, wacky hijinks, like, oh, if I get rid of Phoebus, then Esmeralda will love me. And when that plan doesn't work once, he's like, well... now I have to get Esmeralda killed. And again, like, he never tries to visit her as a prisoner. Like, he doesn't use the, like, you know, because of the implication sort of rule. He just lets her die.
Yeah, so this is when Phoebus shows up, and Frollo is like, shit, you just found out that I'm the one who did it. And then he's like, well, wait a minute. If Phoebus is alive, who did I stab and then throw out the window? And that's when an even more disheveled Clopin shows up, and he's like, hey, Frollo, why the fuck did you stab me and throw me out the window?
So at this point, Frollo's like, man, my plan went all out of whack. I can't kill anybody, right? But he still wants to kill somebody? So he asks for permission, just kind of to the crowd, if he can kill himself. And Pierre's like, yeah, sure, man, go right ahead. And he's about to when Esmeralda's like, whoa, 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 hold on a second. And then addresses the audience. And then says to the audience, how can we really blame Frollo for, like, stirring up the emotions of the people? Which he never really does. There aren't really any, like, crowd scenes in this.
Couldn't afford it.
But basically her little moral at the end of this story is like, hey guys, don't let people stir your emotions up. Which, like, I guess is kind of a theme of Hunchback in general, you know? That, like, I don't want to just say, like, don't listen to people when they accuse people of witchcraft. But, you know, I mean, obviously Victor Hugo is like, man, when mobs rule, that's no good.
I have to point out, since you said that, I don't think there is any, like, mention of witchcraft in this version.
Oh, no.
Esmeralda's just someone who dances and is hot, and people want to fuck her. There's no witchcraft.
Not even Frollo is like, oh, she's a witch. Like, no, he just accepts the fact that she's hot and wants her to die anyways. So yeah, the ending moral pretty much only makes sense if you're familiar with other adaptations, but I think that's kind of the point of the whole thing. So yeah, here, the moral, the lesson of Hunchback, according to these vaudeville performers, is that, you know, like, mob justice can be blind, can be cruel and unfair to people.
The real villain of The Hunchback of Notre Dame is society.
Basically, yeah, like, Esmeralda's like, we were all the villain, which, like, honestly, I don't mind that. I think that's, like, a perfectly decent lesson to get out of Hunchback. There are definitely worse lessons to get out of this. I mean, it's just, it's fun. Honestly, it's fun. And, like I said, like, it doesn't, it's not trying to make any kind of grand statement about society or people, you know, in the way that the book does. And I think, like, a reason why I didn't like the opera is because it kept the seriousness and the melodrama of the story while not making a point. This adaptation, however, doesn't take itself seriously, so I don't feel like I have to take it seriously either. And because of this, I can't fault it for not making a grand statement about humanity. It fits a little one there at the end, and it honestly didn't have to, but I appreciate the little direction it took at the end there. I think that, like I said just before, I think it fits in well with Hunchback, both the book, and I think it does. It isn't too far off base, this funny little play. Yeah, I mean, it's not a great adaptation. You know, it really doesn't have much in common with the book at all. But if you are, I don't know, could we call ourselves hunchheads?
I like that.
Yeah, so if you're hunchheads like us, I think you'll get a kick out of some of the jokes and out of some of the concepts.
Well, I mean, the reason I was a little surprised to hear you say how much you liked it, I didn't hate it. I enjoyed it, but I just thought it was not really very good. I mean, you know, standards change over time. I'm sure this was extremely funny to the audience that it was intended for. It's just so bogged down in things that just don't make sense. It got on my nerves a little bit, and I tried, you know, not to let it bother me, and I got past it. It was not a big deal, but it was just not, it just didn't have, like, the material there for, like, something that you could really enjoy.
See, I think I haven't enjoyed anything in a normal way in a long time, and because my brain has been so infected by reading classic literature, I think I've just, like, come to this place when it comes to analyzing media and enjoying media where I no longer, like, try to make things make sense in my head. There are so many, like, little references that, like, Victor Hugo uses that I don't pick up on that I'm just, like, I've found a sort of inner peace. And so that's kind of how I approached this as well. I tried to kind of silence those parts because I knew as soon as I, like, started reading this that it wasn't going to make a whole lot of sense. So instead I just kind of tried to approach it as, like I said earlier, something that doesn't take itself seriously. So I couldn't really take it seriously either. But I think that's okay for something that isn't trying to be serious. We really tried to adapt to this one, didn't we?
Yeah. Which is to say, I've been Ben Schultz.
I've been Nora Schultz.
And you have been listening to Trying to Adapt.
Thank you.